Imagine this. You just closed like a huge $500 million IPO.
Oh yeah, best feeling in the world.
Right. The pricing call was flawless. The champagne has been popped. The closing dinner was a massive success. And you feel like a total master of the
You're on
universe.
top of the world.
Exactly.
Dang.
But fast forward 3 years, you're sitting at your desk on a random Tuesday, and a federal subpoena lands in your inbox.
Oof, that's a bad Tuesday.
It's the worst Tuesday. Angry investors are suing, regulators are knocking on your door, and your entire career defense basically rests on a cardboard box of old emails and spreadsheets.
Yep, welcome to the post-execution hangover.
Seriously. But first, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. If you're prepping for the Series 79, they've got a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing.
Which you absolutely need.
Yeah, it is exactly what you need to avoid those test day surprises. So check it out at certfuel.com.
Highly recommend.
All right, so let's get into the unglamorous, highly testable world of post-execution financing activities.
It really is a hangover. I mean, everyone wants to celebrate the closing of a deal, but the reality is, this is when the most critical regulatory and administrative work actually begins.
The fun stuff is over.
Yeah, exactly. We are unpacking the paperwork, the billing, the record keeping. And if you were studying for the Series 79, this material is heavily, heavily tested.
Oh, yeah.
It is the absolute backbone of compliance.
You're not just talking about, filing papers in a cabinet so the office looks tidy for the boss.
Oh, far from it. This is about broker-dealer survival.
Right.
If the SEC or FINRA comes looking, or if there's a massive class action lawsuit from those angry investors years down the line, these rules dictate exactly what evidence you have, where it is located, and how fast you can hand it over.
It is your shield.
It's your only shield.
So, to make sense of this dense regulatory web, we are going to use a recurring cast of fictional characters today.
I love this.
Yeah, having names and faces attached to these rules makes them so much easier to remember, especially for those of us who kind of zone out during dry lectures.
Oh, guilty.
So, picture three people. First, we have Manager Mike.
Okay, Manager Mike.
He is the stressed-out lead syndicate manager who ran the deal. He's got the weight of the world on his shoulders, and now he has to keep track of the money and all the compliance rules.
Sounds exhausted already.
He is. Second, we have co-manager Kathy.
Right.
She is the eager syndicate member. She participated in the deal, she did her job, and now she is just constantly banging on Mike's door, wanting to get paid her slice of the pie.
Show me the money.
Exactly. And finally, the most terrifying character in our story, Regulator Randy.
Oh boy.
He is the strict, no-nonsense FINRA or SEC examiner who just randomly shows up to Mike's office demanding meticulous files from a deal that closed 3 years ago.
That is the perfect cast, honestly, because all the rules we're covering today basically govern the friction and the interactions between Manager Mike, Co-Manager Kathy, and Regulator Randy.
Everything flows through them.
Everything.
So let's start at the very beginning of the hangover. Before co-manager Kathy gets a single dime wired to her bank account, manager Mike has to build what is known in the industry as the deal file.
The infamous deal file.
Right. Why? Because regulator Randy might ask for it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the mechanics of this deal file.
Yeah, so the deal file is essentially the underwriter's archived record of an executed financing. But here is the critical thing you have to understand about the timeline. It is not just a closing artifact.
What do you mean?
Well, it doesn't just suddenly spring into existence on the morning the deal closes. It opens the very moment the mandate is won.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it stays open, accumulating documents day by day, all the way through final settlement.
I just picture like the ultimate hoarder's scrapbook of a multi-million dollar transaction.
This is pretty much what it is.
Literally anything that touched this deal goes in the box.
Yeah.
Manager Mike is just tossing, scribbled napkins, email printouts, and pitch books into this massive cardboard box under his desk.
It's a messy visual, but it's a highly accurate one. If it touched the mechanics of the deal, it goes in the box.
Okay, so what exactly is in this scrapbook?
Well, the Series 79 outline specifically lists six required contents of this deal file, and each one maps to a different stream of work.
Let's hear them.
First, you have correspondence.
Row.
But the rule here is strict. You cannot just throw all your emails into one giant bucket.
No.
No, it must be segmented into three distinct channels: the underwriting group, the selling group, and the issuer.
Okay, if I'm thinking through the mechanics of a syndicate, separating those makes total sense because they represent completely different risk profiles, right?
Exactly.
Like the underwriting group is manager Mike and co-manager Kathy, they actually share the financial liability of buying the shares.
Right, they have real skin in the game.
And the selling group are just the broker-dealers acting as agents, right? Like,
yeah.
They distribute shares, but they take no underwriting risk.
Yes.
And then the issuer is the company raising the money, Frank, yeah. The founder, whoever. Mm-hmm.
That's precisely it. They represent totally different legal and regulatory relationships.
Gotcha.
I mean, if regulator Randy is auditing how manager Mike allocated risk among his co-managers, he doesn't want to dig through 3,000 emails Mike sent to the issuer's CFO about the catering for the roadshow.
Right. Randy doesn't care if they had chicken or fish.
He really doesn't.
Yeah.
Segmenting the correspondence creates a clean audit trail.
Okay, so that brings us to the second item in the hoarder's box, pitch and marketing materials.
Yep.
The pitch book used to win the mandate, plus the marketing materials used to actually sell the offering to investors.
Right. And here is where we really need to test the logic.
Oh, I love a good hypothetical. Listen up, everyone. Direct question to you, the listener.
Pay attention.
Pause and think about this before I reveal the answer. If manager Mike pitched this deal to the issuer 6 months before he even won the mandate, do those early pre-mandate pitch books go into the official deal file? Take a beat.
Let them think.
What's the answer?
The answer is absolutely yes.
Wow. Really? Even 6 months prior?
Yes. Even though they predate the official engagement, they are the foundational record of exactly how the underwriter sold their services. It shows how they framed the transaction in the first place. Regulators want to know what promises were made to win the business.
Nothing escapes the scrapbook.
Nothing.
Okay, what else is Mike throwing in there? What's category three?
Categories three and four cover the actual marketing execution. Right. So roadshow information and book building documents.
What does that look like in practice?
This includes the investor presentation decks, the schedules of one-on-one meetings with institutional buyers, the order logs, the indications of interest, and the final allocation worksheets showing exactly who got what shares.
Just massive spreadsheets, basically.
Tons of them.
And the fifth category is prospectuses, preliminary pricing, and final.
Right.
Now, if you are taking the exam next week, I would write this next part down in bold ink because this is exactly the kind of linguistic trap they set for you.
It's a classic trap.
The exam loves to throw around the term red herring, like it is some completely separate, highly secretive fourth document.
Yeah, they do.
It is not. The red herring is simply the preliminary prospectus.
That's all it is. It is entirely a nickname.
Why do they even call it that?
Well, historically, a preliminary prospectus had this mandatory disclaimer printed in bright red ink down the left side of the cover page.
Oh, literal red ink.
Literal red ink.
Yeah.
And it was warning investors that the information was incomplete and the securities couldn't be sold yet. Hence the red herring.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah. So do not let a multiple choice question trick you into thinking a red herring and a preliminary prospectus are two different things that both need to be in the file. They're one and the same.
Good to know. Okay, and the final sixth category for the deal file.
Copies of all underwriting materials. Mm. This means the engagement letter, the agreement among underwriters, the underwriting agreement with the issuer.
All the heavy legal stuff.
Exactly. Comfort letters from the auditors and all legal opinions from counsel.
So manager Mike is sitting there with this giant overflowing box of six distinct categories. What is the ultimate purpose?
Right. Why are we doing this?
Yeah, we know he has to keep it, but what does this box actually do for him in the real world, aside from taking up space?
There are four specific regulatory purposes you need to know. First, it's just basic record-keeping compliance.
Yeah, right.
It's just the cost of doing business as a broker-dealer.
The baseline.
Right. Second, it serves as the audit trail for regulator Randy. If Randy wants to reconstruct exactly how a deal was priced or investigate if favored clients got unfair allocations, the file provides the chronological map.
You can follow the breadcrumbs.
Exactly. Third, it tracks billing and finalization. The deal file holds the expense records that determine who gets paid what.
Which keeps co-manager Kathy from rioting.
Precisely.
And the fourth purpose is the big one for Mike's personal survival. The Securities Act diligence defense.
Yes. Let's go back to your opening scenario.
The awful Tuesday.
Terrible Tuesday. Investors sue manager Mike 3 years later, claiming there were material lies or omissions in the registration statement. They say Mike sold them a garbage company.
Okay.
This box is Mike's golden shield. Under the Securities Act of 1933, an underwriter can avoid liability if they can prove they conducted a reasonable investigation and had reasonable grounds to believe the statements were true.
Oh.
The deal file is the physical proof of that reasonable investigation. It shows he did his homework.
It sighs the, I might have been wrong, but I wasn't negligent defense.
Exactly. I did the math. Here's my work.
But here's the thing. Manager Mike can't just toss all these papers into a literal shoebox and call it a day.
No, absolutely not.
He has to follow strict regulatory recipes for creating these records. The factory floor of compliance, if you will.
That's a good way to look at it.
And when I look at the outline for this section, I immediately see a huge point of friction. I see FINRA rules and I see SEC rules.
Got it.
How do I tell them apart? They seem to be talking about the exact same stuff.
The very common point of confusion. Because they seem to overlap, but they serve different functions. Let's separate them cleanly.
Please do.
Think of the FINRA general record keeping rule as the hook and the floor.
The hook and the floor.
Right. It is incredibly broad. It essentially says, hey, FINRA members, you must follow all the SEC rules. That's the hook.
It just pulls you in.
Exactly. And then it provides a floor. It sets a default 6-year retention period. Only for those rare FINRA records that don't have a specific timeline mentioned anywhere else.
Okay, so FINRA is really just pointing a finger at the SEC and saying, do what they say, and if they forgot to give you a deadline for something, hold on to it for 6 years.
Exactly. The actual substance, I mean, the detailed shopping list of what documents you have to create in the first place that lives in the SEC's records to be made rule.
Records to be made.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is the rule that mandates the creation of blotters, ledgers, order tickets, and customer account information.
So here is a nuance to watch out for. Direct exam tip here.
Listen close.
Do not use the FINRA rule to answer a question about which specific records must be created.
Right.
The FINRA rule is just the enforcement mechanism. The SEC rule tells you the what to make.
And just as importantly, the SEC rule dictates when to make them.
Ah, timing.
The regulation requires that these records reflect the broker-dealer's activity as of the date it occurs. And for most standard records, they generally have to be prepared no later than the following business day.
Wait, I'm going to push back on that.
Okay, go ahead.
Does literally every single record have to be created by the next business day? Like, if Manager Mike does a complex block trade on Tuesday, does he need a fully updated monthly trial balance or net capital computation finished by Wednesday morning?
That sounds intense.
That sounds mechanically impossible for a massive bank.
Good catch. And you are right to push back, because that is a trap. The rule says records must generally be prepared by the following business day, but that is not a universal deadline across the board.
Oh.
You have to think about the nature of the record. Transactional items like trade blotters and order tickets, those are daily. They must be done by the next business day.
Right, because the trade happened today.
Exactly. But a monthly trial balance obviously runs on a monthly accounting cycle. The key principle is that the record must be created concurrently with the business cycle it measures.
That makes a lot more sense. I was imagining poor Mike never sleeping.
He sleeps a little.
Yeah.
But yeah, if it's a monthly metric, it's done monthly.
Okay, so where does our giant deal file, the hoarder's scrapbook, fit into this factory floor of SEC rules? Are there separate rules for underwriting documents?
Not really.
Yeah.
The deal file seamlessly integrates into the standard broker-dealer framework. Underwriting documents aren't some separate magical category of SEC rules.
Okay.
Syndicate correspondence just flows into the standard communications retention bucket. Allocations and order logs go into the standard order ticket bucket.
It's all the same filing system.
Exactly. The deal file is just a practical, transaction-specific container for standard broker-dealer records.
All right, so Manager Mike has successfully manufactured all the records. The factory has produced the goods. Now we shift from creation to storage.
The storage wars.
Yes. Regulator Randy is walking through the door and he wants to know exactly how long we are keeping these records and where they are located.
And this transition moves us from the SEC's records to be made rule to their records to be preserved rule.
Listen up, change of pace. We're changing the energy.
Pop quiz.
Rapid fire pop quiz time. Right. Wake up, everybody. The exam loves testing timelines. I'm going to name a document. Let's see where it goes. But first, give me the architecture. What are the three main retention tiers?
The three core retention tiers for a broker-dealer are 6 years, 3 years, and life of the enterprise.
Okay, tier one is 6 years. If I'm thinking about what needs to be kept the absolute longest, aside from the firm's actual existence, it makes sense that the foundational financial architecture lives here.
That is the exact right logic. Hmm. The six-year tier holds the principal records, the financial DNA of the firm.
What's in it?
General ledgers, customer ledgers, and trade blotters. But there is one more crucial item in that six-year bucket that trips people up.
What is it?
the customer account records, which heavily features the Know Your Customer or KYC files.
Oh, that totally makes sense, because if you lose a client's core identity and risk profile, you lose the basis for literally every trade you've ever recommended to them.
Exactly. You can't prove why you did what you did if you don't know who they are.
Okay, tier two is 3 years. What falls into this bucket?
If the 6-year bucket is the financial DNA, the 3-year bucket is the transactional chatter.
Chatter. I like that.
Yeah, this includes order tickets, trade confirmations, and most importantly, communications. Emails, instant messages, and any business-related social media.
Here's a massive warning for test day, guys. The exam absolutely loves swapping the 3-year and 6-year items to see if you're paying attention.
So they do it all the time.
Order tickets and emails are 3 years. Ledgers and KYC customer accounts are 6 years. Do not get those flipped. It really helps to remember that an email is fleeting, so it's 3 years. A ledger is foundational, so it's 6.
That's a perfect way to remember it.
All right, tier three is life of the enterprise and any successors. What goes in there?
The soul of the company. Organizational documents, articles of incorporation, partnership articles, minute books from the board of directors meetings.
Notice there is no fixed number of years there. It hers of the life of the firm, plus whoever buys them out.
Forever, basically.
Okay, now let's talk about the easily accessible rule. Because we established that Regulator Randy is notoriously impatient.
Very.
When he asks for a file, he doesn't want to hear that it will take 3 weeks to find it.
He does not. For both the 3-year and 6-year retention tiers, the general rule states that for the first 2 years of a record's life, it must be kept in an easily accessible place.
My favorite analogy for this, easily accessible means it is in the filing cabinet right next to Manager Mike's desk.
Reach out and touch it.
Right. If Randy asks for an email from last year, Mike can just turn around, open a drawer, and physically hand it to him.
Yep.
But once that email celebrates its second birthday, Mike can put those boxes on a truck and ship them to a dark, dusty, cheap storage warehouse in New Jersey.
Out of sight.
The documents are still being retained for their full 3 or 6 year legal requirement, but Rand just has to wait a few days for the truck to bring them back if he asks for them in year 4.
That is exactly the distinction. It's not about how long you keep them. It's about retrieval time. But this raises a very important caveat.
Oh, boy.
There are massive exceptions to this 2-year easily accessible rule, and they are prime exam material.
Let's hear them, because general rules always have traps.
Always. The first 2 years is the general rule, but for detailed customer information, those KYC records we talked about, and for associated person records, they must remain easily accessible for their entire retention period. Not just the first 2 years.
Wow. Wait, so Manager Mike can never send the KYC files or the employment files of his brokers to the New Jersey warehouse?
Never.
They stay in the cabinet right by his desk for the full 6 years, or however long they are required.
Yes, exactly.
Why did the SEC carve those out?
Well, think about it. If a regulator is investigating immediate fraud or a rogue broker, they cannot wait a week for a warehouse to pull a pallet of files.
Oh, true.
They need to know exactly who the client is and exactly what the broker's disciplinary history is right this second.
That makes a lot of sense.
And speaking of associated person records, meaning employment history, background checks, and disciplinary files for the actual humans working at the firm, the clock on those is entirely different.
Different how?
They must be kept for 3 years after termination, not 3 years from creation.
That is a huge distinction. If Mike hires a broker who works there for 20 years, Mike is keeping those easily accessible records for 23 years.
Yes.
The retention clock doesn't even start ticking until the employee clears out their desk and leaves the firm.
Exactly.
What about customer complaints? Like when co-manager Kathy's clients get angry and write a furious letter claiming they were misled.
Now, this is where we see a direct conflict between FINRA and SEC timelines.
Okay. Lay it on me.
The SEC generally considers complaints part of the 3-year communication bucket. But FINRA rules specifically dictate that written customer complaints must be kept for 4 years.
So which one does Manager Mike follow? 3 or 4?
In compliance, you always follow the stricter rule. Because FINRA requires 4 years, broker-dealers must retain written customer complaints for 4 years.
4 years. Got it. If you see a question about customer complaints, lock in the number 4.
Right. Always 4.
Okay, let's talk about the physical reality of this. Because Manager Mike isn't actually using a cardboard box or a physical filing cabinet in modern finance. It is all electronic.
Oh yeah, completely digital.
How does the SEC regulate the digital filing cabinet?
They have incredibly strict rules on electronic storage formats to prevent tampering. Historically, electronic records had to be exclusively maintained in a non-rewritable, non-erasable format.
Like it's carved in stone.
Basically.
Huh.
In the industry, we call this WORM, Write Once, Read Many.
WORM.
Think of the old days of burning data to a CD-ROM. Once the laser etched the data into the disk, it could not be altered, edited, or deleted by anyone ever.
But no one uses CD-ROMs anymore. I mean, everything is in the cloud. How does WORM work on an AWS server?
Well, it doesn't really, which is why the rule was updated to reflect modern technology.
Okay, good.
The SEC introduced an audit trail alternative.
What's that?
You no longer have to use a strict WORM format, provided that your electronic record-keeping system maintains a complete, time-stamped audit trail.
Okay, so it tracks everything.
Yes. This system must log every single time a document is accessed, modified, or deleted, and it must be able to perfectly recreate the original unaltered record if a bad actor tries to change it.
And Regulator Randy needs a VIP all-access pass to this digital system, right?
Oh, he absolutely does. To use electronic storage, the firm must provide a formal undertaking to regulators.
An undertaking? That sounds ominous.
It is a bit. It is essentially a legally binding promise that the firm will furnish the records promptly upon request. And here is the key testable point.
Tell me.
This undertaking must be signed by either a designated executive officer, which means a senior responsible insider at the broker-dealer, or an unaffiliated designated third party.
So Manager Mike, as a senior executive, could be the one legally holding the digital keys and taking responsibility?
Yes.
Or if they outsource their server management, they could hire an outside data compliance firm to sign the undertaking.
Right. Just as long as Randy has a guaranteed point of contact who can unlock the servers when he shows up.
Precisely. The regulators just need to know exactly who to subpoena if the data is suddenly inaccessible.
Exactly. They don't want to hear, oh, AWS is down. They want a person on the hook.
All right. So Manager Mike has stored all the paperwork flawlessly. The records are pristine. But now we reach the climax of the hangover.
The part everyone cares about.
Co-manager Kathy is banging on Mike's office door. The deal is done, the champagne is flat, and she wants her money.
Show me the money.
How does the syndicate actually get paid? This brings us to syndicate settlement and billing.
And this is where we have to look very closely at the timeline. To understand how Kathy gets paid, we have to clearly distinguish between two completely different milestones.
Okay, what are they?
The syndicate settlement date and final settlement.
Break that distinction down for me, because syndicate settlement date and final settlement sound identical to someone taking a multiple choice test in a panic.
They really do.
Mm-hmm.
But they represent totally different parts of the transaction.
Okay.
The syndicate settlement date is the starting gun.
The starting gun.
Right. It is the specific day that the issuer, I mean, the company raising the money, actually delivers the securities to the syndicate against payment.
Okay.
It represents the moment the shares physically change hands. This happens at or very near the actual closing of the deal.
Okay, so syndicate settlement date equals delivery day, the day the goods arrive.
Correct. Now, final settlement is the deadline for Manager Mike. Final settlement is the date when Mike officially closes his syndicate accounting books and wires the final net profit to Kathy and the other syndicate members.
Got it.
Under the standard legacy rule, Manager Mike has up to 90 days following the syndicate settlement date to effect final settlement.
So Mike has 90 days from the starting gun to finish the math and pay everyone.
Yes.
Direct question to the listener here. Let's see if you caught the nuance. Pause and think. If a massive IPO prices on a Tuesday night, but the issuer doesn't actually deliver the shares to the syndicate until Thursday morning, when does Manager Mike's 90-day clock start? Tuesday or Thursday?
Let him think.
The clock starts on Thursday, the delivery date.
Absolutely. You cannot anchor the 90-day clock to the pricing date.
Why not?
Because Mike can't start calculating the final payout of a deal until he actually holds the underlying securities from the issuer. Delivery is what triggers the administrative clock.
Okay, so Manager Mike has a full 90 days. What on earth is he doing for 3 months? Why does it take so long to cut a check?
He is building the P&L, the profit and loss statement, for the entire syndicate account. And that takes time because bills trickle in slowly. Lawyers are notoriously slow with billing.
True. Let's unpack the P&L buckets. What is he calculating?
He is balancing three main buckets: income, expenses, and allocation. On the income side, he is tallying up the gross underwriting spread, plus any reallowances or proceeds from exercising a green shoe over allotment option.
Let me stop you right there to flag a major exam concept. The gross underwriting spread is not just one big monolithic number.
No, it's not.
It has three distinct parts, and you have to know them.
Yes, very important.
The manager's fee, which Mike takes for running the deal, the underwriting fee, which compensates the syndicate for taking on the risk of buying the shares, and the selling concession, which goes to whoever actually finds the buyer and sells the stock. You have to know those three pieces make up the gross spread.
You absolutely do.
Okay, what about the expenses bucket? What's draining the account?
Expenses include the massive legal counsel bills, the logistical costs of the roadshow hotels, flights, catering printing costs for the prospectuses, and crucially, stabilization losses.
Oh boy.
Once Mike figures out the total income and subtracts the total expenses, he moves to the final bucket, allocation.
Right.
This is simply calculating each syndicate member's net share based on the percentages they agreed to in their original contract, the agreement among underwriters, or AAU.
I want to focus on that expense bucket for a second, specifically stabilization, because stabilization is super risky.
It is.
Let's look at an absurd scenario. What if manager Mike went into the open market to stabilize the price of the stock because it was dropping like a stone on its first day of trading?
Panic mode.
Exactly. He buys aggressively to prop up the price, but he completely botches it. The stock crashes anyway, and he loses a ton of money on those stabilization trades. Does manager Mike eat that loss all by himself because he was the one trading?
What's fascinating about syndicate mechanics is, no, he doesn't. Stabilization is undertaken on behalf of the entire group. Therefore, stabilization losses hit the syndicate account as a whole expense. The entire syndicate absorbs those losses pro rata based on their underwriting commitment.
Wait, so co-manager Kathy, who had literally nothing to do with those trades, might open her final statement and realize the stabilization losses completely wiped out her selling concession, and she actually owes Mike money.
Exactly. If the stabilization losses and legal fees outstrip her specific share of the gross spread, she has to wire money to the manager. She operated at a loss.
That is absolutely brutal. It's like a group of friends splitting a dinner bill evenly, and at the end of the night, you realize manager Mike ordered $10,000 worth of imported caviar without asking anyone. Everyone absorbs the loss pro rata.
Yeah.
Kathy is going to be furious when she gets that bill.
Which is exactly why the regulatory rules require manager Mike to provide extreme documented transparency. To prevent Mike from just making up numbers, he is required to send Kathy a detailed itemized statement showing exactly how he did the math.
He has to prove it.
Yes, it must show her share of the compensation, her proportional share of the expenses, and the final net amount owed to her or owed by her.
And when does Kathy get this receipt for the caviar? Does she have to wait forever?
The timing rule is incredibly strict. The itemized statement must arrive no later than the date of final settlement. You cannot wire the money on day 89 and then mail the itemized statement explaining the math on day 95.
Got it.
The money and the math must happen concurrently by day 90 at the latest.
And I also recall reading that manager Mike can't just hide that $10,000 caviar charge in a miscellaneous category, right?
Correct. FINRA is very clear that the miscellaneous category on the itemized statement cannot be disproportionately large, and it absolutely cannot be used as a dumping ground for major expenses to avoid scrutiny. Everything, major legal fees, roadshow costs, stabilization losses, must be clearly broken out and categorized.
Okay, here is where this topic gets a massive plot
Oh,
twist.
yeah, the new rule.
If you are using old study materials, throw them out. In 2022, FINRA introduced the two-stage rule, completely altering this 90-day waiting period.
They did. And because it's relatively new, it is a prime target for the modern exam.
Okay, break it down.
FINRA looked at the market and realized that forcing syndicate members like Kathy to wait 90 full days for their cash creates a tremendous amount of credit risk and ties up institutional capital unproductively.
Right. She can't use that money to fund other deals.
Exactly. So they amended the rule to speed up payments, but, and this is vital, only for one specific type of offering, public corporate debt.
Why specifically corporate debt? Why not equity?
Because the debt markets operate differently than equity markets. Corporate bond deals generally have fewer trailing expenses and less complex stabilization needs than a volatile equity IPO.
The math is just simpler.
Much simpler. The final match is usually clearer much faster. So FINRA determined there was no justifiable reason for the lead manager to hold on to all that cash for 3 months.
So how does the two-stage rule work for co-manager Kathy?
If the deal is public corporate debt, manager Mike must remit at least 70% of the gross amount due to Kathy within 30 days of the syndicate settlement date. That is stage one.
So instead of waiting 3 months, she gets 70% of her money in 1 month. That frees up her capital significantly.
Exactly. Then comes stage two, which is the final true-up.
Okay.
The remaining balance, after all the final legal and administrative expenses are fully calculated, is due within the standard 90-day window, right alongside the itemized statement.
Let me be absolutely clear about how the exam will test this. Do not apply this two-stage 70-30 rule to an equity IPO.
Do not do it.
If a test question asks about an initial public offering of stock or a follow-on equity offering, it is still just the legacy 90-day single-stage rule. No early money for Kathy on equity deals. The 30-day payout is a corporate debt-specific rule.
You have to read the question carefully to identify the security being sold. If it says bonds or notes, think two-stage. If it says common stock, think 90 days.
Perfect. To close out this section of The Hangover, I want to do a side-by-side comparison of the four primary documents that Manager Mike produces at the end of a deal.
Good idea.
Because they all sound extremely similar. They all summarize the transaction, but they go to very different places and serve totally different masters. Let's compare them.
That is a great way to synthesize the information. First, you have the syndicate account settlement memo.
The memo is internal. That is Mike's own math scratch pad, the work papers he uses to calculate the buckets we just talked about.
Second, the itemized statement.
The statement is external and regulatory. That is the final receipt that co-manager Kathy gets so she can see the math and verify she isn't paying for Mike's caviar.
Third, the closing binder, which is sometimes called the transaction Bible.
The binder is legal. That is the massive, beautifully bound compilation of all the executed contracts, opinions, and agreements put together by the lawyers. It sits on a shelf to prove the deal happened legally.
And fourth, the league table submission.
The league table submission is purely reputational. Mike sends the deal data, the size, the pricing, his role as lead manager to data aggregators like Bloomberg or Dealogic, so his bank gets credit in the industry rankings.
It's for bragging rights.
Total bragging rights. And listen, here is a fantastic trick question. If Manager Mike is late submitting that data to Bloomberg, it is a competitive failure for his bank's marketing department. It is not a Fenneron rule violation.
No, no.
Regulator Randy does not care about your Bloomberg rankings. The SEC does not care where you sit on a league table.
Spot on. It is one overall transaction work stream, but it yields four totally distinct outputs with completely different audiences. Internal, regulatory, legal, and reputational. Keep those distinct in your mind.
All right. We made it to the final polish. The hangover is subsiding. Time for a rapid-fire recap of the top testable takeaways so this sticks in your brain for exam day.
Number one, the red herring is simply the preliminary prospectus. It is not a separate document.
Number two, the FINRA rule says to follow the SEC. The SEC records to be made rule tells you exactly what to create. The SEC records to be preserved rule tells you how long to keep it.
Number three, 6 years for the financial DNA like ledgers and KYC. 3 years for transactional chatter like order tickets and emails. Life of the enterprise for organizational docs.
Number four, easily accessible means the first 2 years in the filing cabinet next to your desk, unless it's KYC or associated person records, which stay easily accessible forever. And remember, associated person records are kept for 3 years after they leave the firm.
Number five, the 90-day final settlement clock starts on delivery. The syndicate settlement date, not the pricing date.
Number six, corporate debt only gets the two-stage rule, 70% of the money in 30 days. Equity deals wait the full 90.
And finally, itemized statements must arrive by final settlement and break out all major expenses. Miscellaneous cannot be a massive dumping ground to hide stabilization losses.
So what does this all mean for you? You now have the mechanistic understanding to conquer this section of the Series 79. You know the why behind the what. But before we log off, I want to hand it over to our expert for one final thought to chew on.
We talked a lot today about the 3-year retention bucket for communications, Regulator Randy checking emails. But think about how technology has blurred that line.
Oh, yeah.
If you are a broker and you text a client a joke or a meme about interest rates on your personal iPhone, you have just conducted business. You've just turned your personal text history into a 3-year SEC record-keeping obligation.
Wow.
In the modern era, the line between off-the-record personal chat and federally mandated evidence is basically non-existent. Think very carefully before you type on any device.
A terrifying and perfect note to end on. If you do business on your phone belongs to Regulator Randy. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us. Keep reviewing those timelines. Go crush your practice exams, and we'll see you next time.